I am Planta on the Line. This is thecommentary.ca. Already a bestseller, the new book, Why Your World is About to Get a Whole Lot Smaller, Oil and the End of Globalization, is a groundbreaking look at the future of the global economy. With cheap energy no longer viable, the way we live will be dramatically different than what we're used to. Oil was high last summer, and this summer it's gone down. However, according to the book's author, it'll go up again. And when oil is in the hundreds of dollars a barrel again, the world will get smaller as we'll retreat to an economy that's in our own backyard. The cost of importing cheap goods won't be as affordable, and thus we won't have berries in the winter or things like that which we've been seemingly used to. Jeff Rubin was chief economist and chief strategist at CIBC World Markets and was one of the first economists to predict soaring oil prices in 2000. He's a much sought-after public speaker and energy expert. The book is published by Random House. He joins me from here in Vancouver this day. Please welcome to the Planta on the Line program, Jeff Rubin. Good morning, Mr. Rubin.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, yourself?
Good.
So it's your contention that oil will never go down in price again?
Oh, not at all. Oil will always fall during a recession, just like it's fallen during this recession. But we note that even in what is being called the deepest recession in the post-war period, not just in Canada, but in the entire oil-consuming world, that oil prices are trading around $70 a barrel. Well, you know, it wasn't that long ago, just a couple of years ago, in fact, that $70 a barrel would have denoted a world all-time record high oil price. Now it's where oil prices trade during the deepest post-war recession. You know, in the future, I mean, we'll have other recessions and oil prices will fall again, but we're going to find that over time, the peaks of one cycle become the trough of the next cycle. So that over time, it's getting more and more expensive to burn oil.
You have this analogy in the book of playing ping pong on a moving train?
That's right. I mean, you may think the ball is going back and forth, but really, it's going ahead all the time.
Now, why is oil so expensive? Is it, I mean, you're talking
about,
is it because of scarcity?
Oil, it's not that the world has run out of oil in some absolute geological sense, not even close to that. But what the world has run out of is oil that you can afford to burn, not only in your car, but the oil that you use to power your whole way of life. Like, sure, there's 165 billion barrels of oil trapped in the Alberta oil sands, but the very prices that will be needed to lift that oil out of the sand to the point where it can replace depleting conventional oil are the same prices that will take you right off the road, because it'll be a prices of $150 to $200 that will be needed to ever fulfill the promise of 4 million barrels a day out of there, but that's going to translate into $7 a gallon or $2 a liter gas.
Is there a connection between the price of oil and the value of the Canadian dollar?
Yes, there's a very strong connection. Of course, the causation doesn't go from the Canadian dollar to oil, but rather from oil to the Canadian dollar. The Canadian dollar is a petrol currency. Maybe the Bank of Canada hasn't figured that out yet, but it should become abundantly clear that that is, in fact, what we are. And the Canadian dollar is going to become even more of a petrol currency over time as Canada plays an even larger role in supplying U.S. oil demand. And that's as much a statement about Canadian oil sands as it is a statement about what's happening in other places, like, for example, Mexico, that was just until recently the U.S. number two supplier. Depletion is going to take Mexican exports and wipe that right off the map. So, you know, the Canadian dollar is going to move lockstep with oil prices, and while that's not going to be a challenge for the folk in Alberta, it sure is going to pose a challenge for other regions and other industries in the economy.
Something that I've never understood, and you're an economist, and I'll ask you, why the price of gas never goes down when the price of oil does?
Well, I mean, there is a thing called the crack spread. Don't forget that oil is a raw material and gasoline is a refined, really manufactured product, and the difference between the two is called the crack spread, or really the refinery margin and cost, or the cost of converting crude into gasoline. And that refinery margin can be often, you know, very important in terms of the price of gasoline. Of course, the other big element in the price of gasoline is so much of the price of gasoline is taxes. For example, the retail gasoline prices in Western Europe right now, I mean, if we want to know, if we want to get an idea of what our world would look like with $2 a liter gas or $7 a gallon gas, just look at Western Europe now, because they're paying those prices and have been for a decade, not because of the price of oil, but because of their much, much higher fuel taxes.
Now, is it your view that with high oil prices, as they go up, as the value of oil, I guess, goes up, that our habits will change? I mean, it didn't seem last year that it changed very much when the price of gas went up.
Well, the price of gas went up, but then it created a recession, and if you talk to the folks in Detroit, that had a huge change, because we went from a vehicle market in the United States of roughly 16, 17 million vehicles a year to a vehicle market 8 million. So that was a pretty significant change. I think what we're going to find is that there will be no economic recovery for the auto industry, because the very recovery that will give people the financial wherewithal to go out and buy a car is the same recovery that's going to give us $4 a gallon gasoline that Americans were already seeing last Memorial Day weekend, and that's going to take people right off the road.
Now, you write in the book that goods will be much more expensive and will be less reliant on imported goods. Does that mean that I like this idea that you're talking about how we'll be that our world will be much smaller, because it seems like a nicer place.
Well, distance is going to cost money, and the very same economics that compelled, you know, the movement of manufacturing and food production away from our economies to places overseas, the very same economics is going to reverse that, because it's not going to be economically viable to import $6 billion worth of food like America did last year from China, because it's just going to cost too much oil to move and refrigerate that food as it crosses an ocean. So, of course, it's not going to be like we're not going to eat anymore. It's going to be that we're going to have to replace those food imports with more local food. That's going to require, a change in diet. We're not going to be able to eat, you know, fresh blueberries and raspberries in the middle of February if you live in Toronto like I do. But it's also, maybe more fundamentally, going to require a change in land use, because if we're all of a sudden going to have to feed ourselves more, the agricultural land that we used to feed ourselves with has been paved over 30 or 40 years ago to be subdivisions. Well, guess what? You know, plunging suburban real estate values and soaring food prices, and those subdivisions may be quickly reconverted back into the farmland that they were only 30 or 40 years ago.
Does this mean that we'll put people like Walmart out of business?
Well, if the idea of Walmart isn't going to be challenged, I'll tell you one thing. Walmart's not going to be sourced by China, that's for sure. I mean, that's not going to be the source of cheaply produced goods anymore, because, as I say, what you save on wage costs, you more than blow on burning bunker fuel. You know, Walmart is basically about the whole global economy, where there's, you know, a big box store in every country in the world, and it doesn't really matter that the factory is on the other side of the world than the customer, because everybody buys the same thing. We all eat the same thing. We all wear the same thing. We all have the same plasma TVs. Well, that's what Walmart serves, but I think that when we go back to local economies, not only will production go back local, but we'll have local customers that, you know, regional cultural differences will emerge. You know, there'll be special local tastes and preferences that got obliterated in the sort of homogeneous global consumer. And so that it'll become more and more important for factories to be close to the markets they serve, and that instead of, you know, trying to find your specialized niche in some, you know, global economy, real economic comparative advantage will be the ability to know and service your own local community.
And a lot of the lost jobs that we've lost over the years, those will come back?
Well, yeah, because, I mean, if we're going to, like, be making our own steel and making our own, you know, all kinds of manufacturing jobs that we thought were gone forever are going to be coming back. Who would have dreamt that triple-digit oil prices could breathe new life into the Rust Belt? But when you consider what it will cost to ship things like steel around the world, you're going to find out that we're going to be able to make those things cheaper here. Not that, you know, not that the price of making things here is going to fall, but rather that the price of importing things from halfway around the world is going to rise so much.
The threat of global warming, will that dissipate?
Well, it won't dissipate, but I'll tell you, there are some silver linings in this smaller world of ours, and certainly this smaller world is a greener world. I mean, the reason that the global economy won't work in a world of triple-digit oil prices is because you have to burn so much oil to move things around. And, of course, when we burn oil, we emit carbon. Going back to a local economy will certainly allow us to produce the same amount of things with emitting a whole lot less carbon. And I think that we're going to find that one of the silver linings is that triple-digit oil prices will do more to restrain carbon emissions than 100 Kyoto agreements.
Now, there's a lot of talk about alternate sources of fuel and the sort. Will we see advancements in technology in that regard?
Well, of course we will. History suggests that triple-digit oil prices and the scarcity that creates will light a pathway to a new energy form and a whole new type of economy. And I'm sure that in 20 to 25 years, we're gonna develop those alternatives. Unfortunately, our rendezvous with triple-digit oil prices is not in 25 years. It's probably within 12 months. So in the here and now, before we can develop these alternative technologies to hydrocarbons, in the here and now, we've got to figure out a way of allowing our economy to produce without consuming so much energy. And ultimately, changing the energy dependency of our economy ultimately depends on changing our everyday life practices.
Now, in a less globalized world that you're talking about in the book, did you foresee that there'll be less conflict?
I'm not sure that there'd be less conflict or more conflict. I mean, let me put it this way. Triple-digit oil prices and peak oil does not have to be apocalyptic. I mean, it will be apocalyptic if we insist on trying to maintain the same type of lifestyles and hence the same type of economy that we enjoyed when oil was cheap and abundant. But, you know, I think that triple-digit oil prices can be a wake-up call, and it can spur us into action that will lead to, you know, us reorganizing our economy. And in many respects, the new smaller world around the corner may be a lot more livable world than the one that we're about to leave behind.
But what are some of the downsides, though, of a less globalized world?
Well, I mean, we're obviously not going to have the mass array of consumer choice, of infinite variety of cheaply produced goods that we have today. I mean, we can probably produce our own plasma screen TVs in North America, but they're going to cost a lot more. So, yes, we're going to be getting back a lot of high-wage manufacturing jobs, but unfortunately, what we'll be able to buy with those wages will be less and less. I mean, this is going to be a highly inflationary world, and, you know, we're not going to be able to have the same kind of consumption lifestyles that we've become accustomed to. I mean, when things break, for example, we'll probably fix them instead of just disposing of them and buying a new appliance, because the cost of replacing it will be much greater. We'll certainly be spending a much larger percentage of our incomes on feeding ourselves, as food costs are likely to escalate dramatically. So, yes, I mean, there are going to be sacrifices, but all I'm suggesting is that peak oil doesn't have to equal peak GDP, that we may have to give up some of the features of our economy, but that there were going to be benefits in adjusting as well.
What's the relationship between rural and urban Canada? Will we see people leave the rural parts of this country or not?
I'm not sure that we're going to see the people leave the rural parts. I mean, if in anything, agriculture is likely to see a revitalization and renaissance because, as I say, we're going to be feeding ourselves more. I'll tell you where we are likely to see an exodus. We're likely to see an exodus from the suburbs because the suburbs, of course, is predicated on cheap oil and people having cars to drive on freeways and drive, you know, 30, 40 kilometers to where they work. I think you're going to see a big movement out of the suburbs back into the inner cities, and I think that's going to be reflected in the real estate market as well.
And then we'll need to rethink public transportation?
We're going to need to rethink public transportation, and unfortunately we need to do that now instead of spending billions of dollars propping up industry doomed to obsolescence like the auto industry. We should be spending those billions of dollars in public transit. And, you know, building buses and streetcars and subways, I mean, that involves workers too. Why couldn't the unemployed workers, the workers being laid off because we're not building Lincoln Navigators and Yukon Denalis and other SUVs, why couldn't those workers build subway cars?
Do you find, Jeff, that governments are addressing this new reality that you're foreseeing, not only here, but also in the United States?
Well, certainly on the necessity to build public transit, no, I don't think so. I think that we're investing in our past, not our future, in bailing out the auto industry. Am I hopeful that will change? I don't have huge confidence in government, but I have huge confidence in prices. And when we see the prices that I'm talking about, and I don't think we're going to have to wait that long to see them, people will know exactly what to do. When, you know, 50 million Americans take the exit lane and want to get on a bus, and there's no bus to take them, they'll get their politicians' attention.
When you travel the country on this book tour and on your various speaking engagements, do you find that people are buying into this, that they see what you're seeing?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the reason the book has done, you know, so remarkably well, at least in the initial 3 weeks, is that this is not necessarily an apocalyptic message, you know. This is a hopeful message and also an empowering message, because the key to weaning our economy off oil isn't with the Bank of Canada or the Federal Reserve Board or the U.S. Treasury or the Department of Finance. The key is with us. It's about the decisions that we make every day in our lives. You know, what we eat, where we live, how we transport ourselves. This is the battle lines of triple-digit oil prices, and this is where real change is going to be made.
I read some speculation on the internet that perhaps CIBC was unhappy with you writing this book. Were they?
Well, they were unhappy with this book being published by their chief economist. I don't think they had any problems with me publishing the book once I was no longer associated with them. It's, you know, not the kind of book that chief economists of investment banks publish, quite frankly. So, you know, I wasn't that surprised. I'm not sure that there would have been too many other investment banks that would have wanted me to publish this book.
So what do you do now?
Well, I'm an author now.
You are, and you speak publicly and do you?
I just spoke with your board of trade today, and I'm right now on a 10-day book tour, one of many.
Yeah. The book is highly readable, I must say, Jeff, and was there a great effort on your part to make
it
readable?
Well, I tried to write the book in pictures instead of, you know, Y equals MX plus B. And I know that economics is a, you know, take the first derivative of Y equals MX plus B discipline, but I think, you know, the challenge of really knowing your stuff is to be able to communicate it in a non-technical way and to be able to communicate it in a picture. And I tried to write the book in pictures or in scenes, and I think I've really come to learn the expression a picture tells a thousand words, because I think it's a much more effective way of communicating. And to the extent that the book has enjoyed success, I think one of the reasons that it's enjoyed success is it takes some concepts that are inherently quite technical and is able to represent them in a way that people can relate to in their own lives.
It is a great book, Jeff. Congratulations on it. And
thank you very much.
You're very welcome. The book is called Why Your World is About to Get a Whole Lot Smaller, Oil and the End of Globalization. It's published by Random House. Its author, Jeff Rubin, on the line. I'm Joseph Planta.